The Heinemann Podcast is a production of Heinemann Publishing. Heinemann is a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers. I'm Brett from Heinemann. Today on the podcast, we're going to talk about a tough issue, dismantling racism in education. Now, not talking about racism is not a solution. So how do we have those conversations, and how do we unravel assumptions and try to find the words to participate in these conversations? Even if you don't have the expertise, we can create safe spaces for the conversations. So how do we get started and move forward? How can these talks bring us together? The Heinemann Fellows recently hosted a panel about racism in education facilitated by Heinemann authors Sara Ahmed, Sonia Cherry Paul, and Cornelius Minor. After the panel, we sat down alongside Heinemann General Manager Vicky Boyd to talk about what racism looks like and how do we break up the assumptions we make about racism. Author Sonia Cherry Paul starts our conversation.
One way that we can define racism is going beyond this notion of racism being simply conscious hate, that it is individual acts of hatred or bullying, but to think about racism systemically and the ways in which it really is the fog over all of our lives, and making a list of those things. So for me as an educator, racism looks like certain people's stories being included in curriculum and in texts that we read while others are being omitted. Racism looks like telling, you know, children of color or teaching children of color to celebrate and honor men, white men in particular, throughout history who were racist and oppressors. Racism looks like teaching children that race doesn't matter when in fact race does matter, to borrow from Dr. Cornel West. And so when we teach kids these sort of canned narratives that race doesn't matter, we're all the same, we're all equal, there really needs to be a paradigm shift where we're teaching our children race does matter in this society. It shouldn't, but it does. And for some of your peers and for some citizens, they're having a very different experience because of the color of their skin. And in our household, we see that as unjust and unfair, and we are pushing back against that. But it's important for you to know that as you are going to school and celebrating the uniquenesses of your peers, that racism is real and it does matter in this society because there are people who make it matter. And I wish that was the narrative that parents were taking in their homes and then teachers can pick up in schools in developmentally appropriate ways to help kids understand this.
And Cornelius, you talked about how, you know, we need to dismantle the assumptions of racism. We typically think of it as acts of violence or acts of hate. At one point, I can't remember who said it, somebody said there's an insistence of innocence among white people. Mm. And you helped us think through the systems in place that allow racism to continue, the systems in place that are racism. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And yeah, I'm really into the idea that systems can be examined and we can look at them and take them apart and add parts to it. And so when I say system, I'm looking specifically at the rules, the policies, the procedures, the customs that govern a specific place. And so when I look at racism, just to give it some historical context, racism is the ideology that justified the transatlantic slave trade. Mm. And it is human nature to be, or really, if you look at Newtonian physics, it's natural to be at rest or in motion, or it's natural to be at stasis. And so when something is not quite balanced, something's wrong. And so we always want to move toward balance. And so when something is wrong, you have to justify why the thing is wrong. And so when you think about transatlantic slave trade, mm-hmm. like that was a vast wrong. And so those people in power had to figure out ways to justify how can this thing be wrong without outrage. And so this invention that there are people called black mm-hmm. or there are people who are brown and those people are less than us. And so that ideology, pervasive. But and what happens is that ideology, it infiltrates systems like schools, like healthcare, like government. And so what happens when you take an ideology like racism and apply it to an institution like school, what ends up happening is that institution produces unequal outcomes for specific subsets of people, specifically like black and brown children. And so given the equal investment of time, energy, love, black and brown children net less of a gain from education or from school than their white peers because this system is in place that guarantees that that will be the outcome. And so when I think about then what are the constituent parts of the system, the constituent parts of the system might be things like school discipline or what counts as work. And so in some schools, if only writing counts as work, the kids who are culturally predisposed to speaking are locked out of success within that system. Mm-hmm. And that happens consistently over time. And so even though there is no ill will or ill intent in that situation, because the very mechanism of what is success and what is not success mm-hmm. is like set up against me, I can never do well within that system. And so what happens is, so the kid who's predisposed to speaking culturally nets less in that system, and then we point at that kid and say, there's something wrong with you, there's a deficit there, when really it's the system that didn't allow that kid opportunities to be successful in the way that, you know, are really important to that kid's particular culture or that kid's particular like racial or ethnic background.
And I think it's also important to point out that the whole notion of schooling, in terms of you were talking about intention, the whole intention of schooling was never to include black and brown children, to always exclude them and to make sure that they didn't have access to education. So to see what you're describing playing out in schools doesn't surprise me. And in fact, I feel that we often try to give people credit and say, you know, but we have the best intentions, when in fact the intentions were not the best, they aren't the best, and they were never the best. So, you know, when we think about what racism is, it's this whole architect of schooling, which was never, ever designed to include brown and black bodies from the beginning. So I feel like there needs to be an incredible overhaul and transformation of schooling in order for everyone's talents to be noticed and for everyone to be considered or have the available ability to be successful.
Cornelius, I want to go back to a story that I've heard you tell a couple of times regarding your wife mm-hmm. and the call center that she works at. And I'd like you to sort of, if you don't mind, share that story and connect that to this conversation and its importance.
Yeah, one of the things, and I have the most amazing wife on the planet, and and she spends a few evenings a week at a sexual violence call center, and that's you wait by the phone all night, and people call in, and we don't really talk about it because it's a confidentiality thing. So like, I don't know what she does all night, but when she volunteered there, like people would call in and she would work people through problems, through crises. And it was a nighttime thing. So she would come home very, very early in the morning. And there was one specific morning that she came home and she was distressed because usually she never wakes me up. She just kind of comes and it's a thing that I acknowledge, but we don't really talk about it because we can't. But this one particular night she said to me, she's like, you know, Cornelius, I really need you to talk to your guy friends about sexual violence. And I need you to talk to them specifically about rape. And that just struck me as an odd request early in the morning. And I was just like, well, you know, it's not a guy thing. Like, why is this something that I need to bring to my circle of guy friends? And she looked at me and she was like, you know, Cornelius, in this community, you're an influential athlete. You're a teacher. A lot of people look at you. And sexual violence is not a woman problem. Like, women didn't create it. Women do not benefit from it. And so it is a man problem. Like, men perpetuate it. Men created it. Men benefit, you know, and so if you're not talking to your guy friends about this, then you are complicit in sexual violence. And that just really struck me, like, you know, as her husband, as a man. And so when I think about then, and I kind of transfer that then to the conversation around race, that that racism isn't something that was created by people of color. It mm-hmm. isn't something that is perpetuated by people of color. It isn't something that people of color benefit from. And so when I think about solutions to racism, like, people of color can't be the only folks doing the work. It has to be white folks mm-hmm. doing the work. That, you know, if I look at, again, like, sexual violence, it has to be men standing up, speaking out, like, and not allowing it to exist in our friendships and in our communities. And then the same applies to racism, that it has to be white folks saying that this has no place in my community.
So we have to get uncomfortable with these conversations. We have to live in that uncomfortable place. Help us figure out, or talk us through, that uncomfortable place we need to get to.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to really face first is there's a lot of truths, right? So there's a powerful and palpable silence about race and racism, right? We are silent because we don't know where to start. Or, you know, we've heard an educator say we only get through 50% of the conversation and don't know where to go. I think that there's a multitude of things that get in the way, but one of those ways to just begin a difficult conversation is to say, okay, I know my truth, I know my experience is truth, but I have to be accepting and understanding and listening to the experience of others and also take those as truth, right? Like, your lived experience is also a truth, just as mine is. Mm-hmm. And until we can even do that, we won't get past a lot of that barrier or a lot of that silence.
Not doing anything is a choice of doing nothing, you know, and to not have those conversations because out of fear that we'll say the wrong thing, especially when white people have that fear and they're sitting there and they're struggling with what to say, how to have that conversation. Choosing not to have those conversations is a choice to do nothing. So how can we, and I want to preface this with a quote that I've heard both you and Sonia say, you know, just because I'm this person, that doesn't make me the diversity expert. And I think that's really important for all people to understand.
I think I can name that because it's something that I struggle with. And if you're on a panel or you're being asked by a school, right, or someone to come and talk to us about race, you know, Sarah, can you come talk to our staff about race? I often question why that is, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't always understand it because I'm brown, it does not make me a diversity expert. It doesn't make me an expert on race. I have lived experiences, mm-hmm. But really what I hope I can bring is the fact that I'm becoming increasingly more comfortable with the discomfort of having these conversations. So I will come to your school as that to help support everyone having those conversations, but not the expert because I'm brown.
And I think it's another way to sort of shift the responsibility of dismantling racism on the people who are affected by racism. So 2 years ago, there was an incident in my school and I reported it to my superintendent, who happens to be white. And his response to me in written format was, "I'm sure that was awful for you. Why don't you go and tell the high school students how that made you feel?" And my response was, nope. The onus is not on me because I happen to be the black person and in this district, and this incident related to name calling and using the N-word. And I felt like this is something we need to tackle as a community, not individual, that one individual who happens to be African-American should go speak out against it. And that was one of the reasons why I started a committee called the Race Matters Committee in my district, where I just got a couple of colleagues who, you know, could come together and talk about that incident and also other issues that had been happening in our district. And I just saw really clearly that I needed to surround myself with allies, because I really felt like I was going to have to quit my job and leave my district because it felt so isolating. You know, this is your problem, Sonia. You go handle it. So I think it the onus is on all of us to do this work. We need to make sure that brown and black voices are heard and that they are at the center of that. But we also need white folks to educate themselves and to learn what they need to do to partner with everyone around them to tackle this problem and not just rely on the people who happen to be affected by it.
And you've also said, too, it's important to not lose sight of racism and attach other things to it and constantly attach other things to it where it then gets lost and forgotten. Can you talk a little bit about how important that is, but also the responsibility of the community to support in that work?
Right. So I work in a district that's predominantly white teachers and white students. And I've noticed that whenever we come around to have a purposeful conversation around diversity, specifically race and racism, it sort of segues into sexism or disabilities and learning challenges and what I've called sort of the safe zones mm-hmm. for the people in my district. And the one thing that always falls to the wayside is racism. I think it is very challenging for people to have these conversations for a litany of reasons. They're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing, or they are just woefully unprepared to have these conversations. And so they don't. And they feel the best thing to do is to say nothing, that to, in fact, engage in these conversations is somehow polarizing and divisive. So it's best that we don't talk about this at all. And so, again, it was important for me to say, no, there's going to be a committee and we're just going to specifically focus on race and racism.
I want to talk about some things that we can do as educators. But before I go there, I feel it's important that we need to go back and examine white privilege. It's a tough phrase to say. It's a tough idea to get out there and have conversations around. And one thing, Sonia, you've taught me is we sometimes will attach privilege to economics. And that is an element of white privilege as well. How can we have these conversations about white privilege in a way where they're open, they're honest, we are uncomfortable, but we're moving forward in our knowledge and we're not sitting in ignorance around it?
So I think one of the best ways to talk about white privilege is to say, aside from economics, now that's a very real privilege. We can't pretend that it doesn't exist. We can just certainly look at our neighborhoods and we can look at the schools and we can compare them to other schools. So, but if we just push that to the side, what are all of the other ways in which privilege lives? So the privilege of being able to go to a library and find a book that has a character on the cover that looks like you and who has a book that has a story that is about you, or as simple as, you know, watching a commercial and finding a product to shampoo your hair, to learn about that from watching TV, which is not an experience that I have. I have to take other measures to find out about different products for my hair as a black woman. I don't have the privilege of just watching network TV and seeing a commercial that is talking about, you know, people like me who have hair like me. So in all these, you know, big and small ways, this is what privilege is. And probably in recent times, the most read piece of writing on privilege is by Peggy McIntosh. But there have been a lot of brown and black folks talking about privilege for years. So we should probably go back and figure out who they are. But, you know, that's an entry point for some people, where she talks about unpacking her invisible knapsack, like, you know, being able to find a Band-Aid that looks like your flesh color. And I've been seeing a lot of discussions about ballet dancers now that we have Misty Copeland in the spotlight, and people, there are brown and black people who are trying to create companies where the point shoes even are coming in different skin tones, because historically there's just one and it doesn't look like mine. So I think we could have these, you know, really obvious conversations about privilege that would then help people, you know, help raise their consciousness. Like, oh, it's not just about economics. Again, economics is a big part of it, but it's all of these other ways that I think people don't think about.
And I want to add something that I heard today in our conversations. It costs white people nothing to speak up. And I felt that was an incredibly powerful statement. I don't remember who said it and at what point it came up, but it just, that really struck me as important.
Mm-hmm. And it's exciting too, because a lot of times we assume that these conversations have to be hard. And one of the things that I always want to recognize is that one of the things that solidifies friendships is shared struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm sitting next to Vicky here and like, I like legit love her. And I think that a lot of that is rooted in that, like, we, in the times that we've spent together, we've talked about like really meaningful things. And so like, to look at these conversations as hard conversations is one thing, but to look at these conversations that are going to solidify friendships, to look at these conversations that are going to like strengthen professional bonds, to look at these conversations and say, these are conversations that are going to sharpen my ability to teach kids, I think that's the win. That no, it's not going to be a difficult conversation for the sake of a difficult conversation. This is going to be a difficult conversation that makes me feel really excited about being around my boss, or this is going to be a difficult conversation. You know, and when we think about difficulty, like I'm a skateboarder, and you do a difficult thing because it's going to pay off. You don't just do a difficult thing for the sake of doing a difficult thing. So I look at a set of stairs and I'm like, I'm going to jump down those stairs because somebody's going to think I'm cool. Like, and I think that's important, you know, that this doesn't always have to be heavy, dark storm clouds. This can be something, I'm going to engage in this thing with my colleague because I love her, or I'm going to engage in this thing with my colleague because I think that like we can be better colleagues to each other if we do this hard thing together. And so always just putting humanity at the center of all of this, that yes, I'm going to do this hard thing, but this hard thing is going to have like real like social payoff in terms of like how effectively I'm able to reach all students, and then like kind of collegial payoff in how well I'm able to like work with my team.
And I think because it's hard, we tend to shy away from it, but just like with skateboarding and doing that really cool jump, it gets easier the more practice you have. So we can get better at having these conversations about race and racism. They can be more fluid, but the way for that to happen is not to not have them.
Exactly.
Like to have them more. And, you know, I was in my work, I've been reading a lot of research, and there was a study that said that 75% of white families never or almost never talk to their children about race. And, you know, when we just think about the intent behind that, where whatever it is, but if we, you know, just ask ourselves, is there any evidence that this assumption works, that our kids are going to be more tolerant and more accepting if we don't talk about race? Where is the evidence for that? It's certainly not, you know, true in 2017. It's not true in 2014. If we all just don't talk about it, we're going to have these children that grow up to be really amazing. And that's not what they do. They grow up and they take these silences and they try to attach some sort of meaning to it because they've been forced to sort of work it out themselves.
Yeah. And wouldn't you guys say that really means too that we don't have to have the answers when we approach the conversation, right? Like you can approach the conversation with humility. Like I think as a society, we're always looking to have the answer at the end of a conversation. But if we leave that conversation asking more questions, then like democracy can evolve, right? Like we can progress in our democracy if we are asking more questions than having to be confident that we have the answers to everything.
Yeah. I think this is Vicky, the white person at the table who's feeling like I need to be a little braver and speak up. This is what it sounds, a white person sounds like, who's trying to learn to find words and participate in these conversations. But, you know, just connecting to Sara, your observation that many of us are reluctant to speak up because we feel like we don't have the expertise. I think this is a particular hurdle for teachers who really feel like, you know, they have to have the background knowledge and the authority. And when we know, as a publisher of progressive resources for teachers, that so much of the work is about creating a safe space for the conversation to happen. And it's really important for the teacher to show up as a student too, and it's okay. This is an opportunity for you to learn alongside alongside your students. I'm sitting here at this table, and I've learned so much. And you know, look for ways, like I'm doing in this conversation, to insert to practice and you know, acknowledge where you are and make a commitment to moving from there forward. One of the things where, one of the reasons I'm at this table is because as a publisher of professional resources for teachers, we recognize that we have a special obligation in this conversation. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the kinds of books that we're putting out, who are the children that are represented in the photographs in those books, mm-hmm. How are we talking about children, how are we representing all populations of children, who are the teachers that get to be in these conversations. And, you know, we're also looking at the makeup of our team here at Heinemann, and we're wanting it to be more reflective of the broader array of humanity. We want to bring all of those perspectives in-house to inform everything that, mm-hmm. that we do. So it's a learning conversation for us, and we feel our responsibility. And we also understand that a lot of teachers perceive us as having a lot of authority. Mm-hmm. And so we better study up and find some words.
Before we wrap this up, I want to give any of our listeners some next steps, some strategies, some things they can do tomorrow or do today, depending on when they're listening. Sarah, certainly something you said at one point, read a book from an author that doesn't look like you. What more? What else? What other small steps can we do, and how can those lead towards bigger steps?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, again, this helplessness of looking to brown educators, educators of color, to say, like, what resources do you have? What do you need? We need those, right? Mm-hmm. And so my response is usually just read something by someone that doesn't look like you. Listen to something, you know, that by someone that doesn't look, listen to another voice. That's just one takeaway these guys have.
And there's a moment a few years ago, I don't know if you remember this, Sarah, like, I was really nervous. I had to teach this, like, institute. And Sarah came on the first day of the institute, and she just sat in my class so that I wouldn't be scared. And she sat there, she sat there, she sat there, and she left early. And when she left, like, a Batman action figure on my desk. And it was really perplexing, because I didn't see her do it. And so I'm in the middle of teaching this thing that I'm really scared to teach, and I go to the desk, and there's, like, a Batman figure, and I just kind of picked it up and I looked at it, and then I turned to the class and I'm like, who did this? and that was like the first moment where I allowed myself to be vulnerable. Like, I was carrying all this stress with me that whole morning, but then just asking a simple question and not knowing the answer and not expecting to ever arrive at one. And so if I were to give teachers any kind of next steps, it's like, be public about asking questions and don't expect to arrive at an answer. That it is totally okay to be vulnerable. It is totally okay to have a question. And it's totally okay to not find the answer today. And what was really interesting in the group, when I held the Batman figure, like, we legitimately didn't know who did it, but everybody had these theories. And it kind of brought us all together. You know, and so the idea that you're not going to solve racism in a 45-minute class period, but people are going to have theories, people are going to have ideas, and they're going to be together. And I think that that's really, really important.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, racism, it's perpetuated by all who do not actively work to dismantle this system. And one of the things that happens a lot is, you know, there are these emotions, whether it's shame or frustration or anger. And there is this sort of idea that, you know, we shouldn't have those feelings. Let's instead be calm and patient and peaceful. And maybe it's the revolutionary in me, but I would like us to lean into those feelings of anger and frustration and shame and, you know, just confusion, and to allow that to galvanize us to action toward dismantling this system. Let's not be afraid of it. Let's channel it and then act in ways that really help our kids and help ourselves and will help the world.
My thanks to Sonia Cherry Paul, Sarah Ahmed, Cornelius Miner, and Vicky Boyd for their time today. I would encourage you to follow all of them on Twitter. And while you're on Twitter, or if you're on Facebook, Sarah mentioned one simple thing you can do right now. Review the people you follow on social media and follow someone who doesn't look like you. Pick up a book and read from someone who doesn't look like you. This is a place to start. I'd also like to thank the Heinemann Fellows and author Ellen Keane for creating the space for this conversation. Be sure to subscribe for more podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Plus, you can get a daily teacher tip right on your phone directly from Heinemann Authors by downloading the Heinemann Teacher Tip app. All this and more on Heinemann.com. Thank you for listening.